This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. One of the biggest adjustments for new parents revolves around sleep, worrying about how little they're getting and making sure their baby gets enough.
Most, quote, normal people sleep 8 hours at night. Infants sleep 16, 17 hours a day, but rarely more than a couple hours at a time.
That story and more coming up this West Virginia Morning. Support for West Virginia Morning is proudly provided by Luke Frazier. The State Supreme Court of Appeals will weigh in on Cabell County and Huntington's opioid lawsuit. Brianna Heaney has more.
In 2022, the city and county lost their lawsuit under the judge's more narrow interpretation of what is considered a public nuisance than previously determined in federal and near statewide opioid lawsuits. The decision was appealed, and now the appellant court has requested that the state Supreme Court weigh in. Huntington Mayor Steve Williams says the nearly 100 million pills that were distributed to his city of less than 45,000 residents led to thousands of overdose deaths.
The reason that we need a settlement is the way that we can create a level of resilience to be able to overcome the curse that was placed on our community as a result of the greed of those companies.
West Virginia Public Broadcasting reached out to the three pharmaceutical companies in the lawsuit but did not hear back in time for broadcast. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brianna Heaney in Charleston.
A tradition at the West Virginia Schools for the Deaf and the Blind allowed kids from across the state show off their braille and cane usage skills. It was placed on hiatus during the pandemic. This year, the tradition made a grand return. Jack Walker visited the school's campus in Romney to learn more.
March marked a special month for the West Virginia Schools for the Deaf and the Blind. For the first time since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, the schools opened their doors to children from across the state for the Braille Challenge and Cane Quest. These two competitions test children's skills at reading and writing Braille and using mobility aids like canes to get around. But on the day of the competition, campus was quiet. That is, except for a rhythmic clicking sound spilling out from behind classroom doors. That's the sound of Braille embossers, which are machines that use pins and weights to indent a sheet of paper with Braille. Children spent hours glued to these machines during the challenge, rhythmically typing away on tasks that tested their reading comprehension, speed and accuracy, and more. Morgan DePalma works at the Children's Vision Rehabilitation Program in Morgantown and helped organize the Braille Challenge this year. She said group activities like these inspire kids to continue practicing their skills independently.
There's different levels of kids, different needs. So whatever level they're at, we just encourage them to keep building off that.
Students who do well in the Braille Challenge can even get the opportunity to travel to California to compete in the national stage of the competition, similar to a national spelling bee. Nearly 40 students attending the School for the Blind or other schools in West Virginia stayed overnight at the Romney campus to compete. They represented 11 counties across the state. In addition to the Braille Challenge, kids also got to participate in Cane Quest. This challenge tests students' ability to use canes as orientation and mobility devices. Bethany Matier, also with the Children's Vision Rehabilitation Program, organized this portion of the competition. She said people often don't see the work that goes into learning how to use a cane or how important a tool it can be.
So a cane is useful in a variety of ways. For the user themselves, it helps them detect drop-off. So that's when it's used appropriately. But again, that goes into learning how to use it and making sure you're using it appropriately.
Plus, canes can help signify to others when a person is blind, including fellow blind people a cane user might meet out in public. There are many barriers to accessible education for students with disabilities. Matier said events like these can help amend gaps in traditional education resources.
They work on technology, they work on independence, they work on self-advocacy, like learning skills, because sometimes they need a little bit more instruction than what their sighted peers might.
For students, an added perk of participating in the Braille Challenge and Cane Quest is getting to meet other students who share their experiences. While some students get to be around peers who are blind or visually impaired year-round at the School for the Blind, others who attend different schools or are homeschooled get fewer opportunities to meet people with similar disabilities. This can be challenging, but it also makes events like these extra fun. For some, events hosted by the School for the Blind have become a years-long opportunity to make friends. Neither Sierra Klein nor Kenzie Hayes attend School for the Blind, but they've known each other since early childhood and say that events like these give them the opportunity to reconnect with friends who live counties apart.
I get the Braille and I just get to hang with the people and the friends that I love.
And same here. I am so happy to get to see all of these people because we live so far away from each other. It's just so nice to get to see everybody.
Sierra and Kenzie are old enough to have participated in the challenge prior to COVID. They say it provides a chance to reconnect with old friends and form new bonds that last well beyond any single event.
I've met some people outside of the challenge. I've met some people in the challenge. It's just very, very nice. I love
everything about everything, literally.
To top off the days of challenges and events, the School for the Blind hosts an end-of-the-week award ceremony, where students get one last chance to be celebrated for their skills. It's a lot of fun. Parents come out to cheer their children on, and students get to hear the results of their hard work. Plus, the students get to participate in one last tradition unique to the school itself, the Braille Challenge Anthem, written and performed by the school community. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jack Walker in Romney.
This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:50. Partly sunny and breezy today. There's a slight chance of rain in the north. High temperatures in the 50s and low 60s. Clear overnight with lows in the 20s. Sunny tomorrow with highs in the 40s and low 50s. Partly sunny on Friday. A chance of rain in the afternoon with highs in the 50s and 60s. Sleep is a key part of both mental and physical health for everyone. But for many parents, ensuring their baby is getting good sleep can be frustrating and elusive. In the latest installment of our new series, Now What?, a series on parenting, reporter Chris Schultz speaks with Dr. Paul Knowles, a Marshall Health neurologist and assistant professor at Marshall University Joan C. Edwards School of Medicine, about infant sleep.
Why is sleep so important for everyone?
You know, we are built to spend a third of our time alive asleep. And unfortunately, as a culture, we have de-emphasized the need for sleep. But sleep is important because it restores you physically and also restores you mentally. There are a number of studies that show that sleep is probably important in learning. You certainly don't fully understand it, but clearly sleep serves a major restorative function. But in addition to that, it's important in learning, organizing your brain and your mind and things like that.
Can you tell me a little bit about why infant and child sleep is different from adult sleep?
Well, anybody who's had a baby knows it's different. Particularly newborns don't sleep like the rest of us. As an older child or an adult, you go through sleep and you move into the lighter stages of sleep and eventually get to the deeper stages of sleep and then into REM sleep or dream sleep. Newborns move immediately into REM sleep. And their neurological systems are not mature enough that they, you know, have prolonged sleep the way we do. You know, most, quote, normal people, sleep 8 hours at night. Infants sleep 16, 17 hours a day, but rarely more than a couple hours at a time. And so they sleep in little cat naps through the 24-hour cycle. Usually by 3 to 4 months, they're starting to sleep the majority of the night. And usually by 6 or 7 months, they're basically sleeping through the night. No, so there's wide individual variation, but you can't really expect a newborn, you know, and some parents get frustrated when their two-month-old isn't sleeping through the night yet, and it's because physiologically they're just not there yet. Their systems haven't matured to the point where they can sustain sleep that long.
Is there anything that parents can do to help that process along? Or?
I mean, there's a little bit, but you have to wait for the baby to mature. It's the same thing as the baby can't walk until the baby has the strength and the coordination to put the muscles together. So it's the same thing. You know, you're not going to be able to train your one-month-old to sleep through the night. I think the parents, you know, particularly as the child gets to be older, keeping a good routine really helps to consolidate that. I see parents, and unfortunately, again, it's a part of our culture, talking typically a little bit more about the older kids, but where the kids over the course of the week may sleep in three different places. They may spend a couple days with the grandparents, a couple days with mom, a couple days with dad, and everybody has a different schedule. And then they're complaining that their children are having sleep issues. And so they have a different schedule everywhere they go. And so they're having problems training their body what their routine should be.
Does the space itself also contribute as much as having a regular schedule and routine does?
I think probably the routine is a little bit more important. Obviously, you want a comfortable space. As a culture, we tend to discourage co-sleeping where the baby's actually in the bed with you. My big issue actually with them having them in the same room is it's very convenient for mom and dad, but sometimes mom and dad are disrupting the kid's sleep. So if somebody's allowed to snore or has something like sleep apnea and is making loud noises and they're disrupting the child's sleep. So that becomes a component.
Sleep training. Is there an evidence base to support this approach to encouraging independent sleep? What can you tell me about this process?
Perhaps one of the most well-known is the Ferber method, F-E-R-B-E-R. And he talks about methods to try and help train your child to be able to put them down, let them get used to the bed, let them self-soothe. If they wake up and they're fussy, you don't go in and you don't console them. You go and check on them and maybe briefly console them if they're really ramping up. But then you leave before they're asleep, so they eventually learn that they're going to have to fall asleep in bed themselves. And there are some studies showing that these sort of mechanisms work. Each individual case is different, and sometimes there may be other issues going on. But I think a lot of times it is difficulty for the parents learning to be able to. And I'll be honest with you, when my kids were little, and I'm in my 60s now, but when I had little kids, my first one, my wife fussed at me because the baby started to cry and I started to get out of bed. She says, just leave her. And I said, well, she's crying. She said, just leave her. And sure enough, you know, 5 minutes later, she, you know, fussed for a couple minutes, then rolled over and fell back asleep. And I didn't have to get up, but the baby had trained me. We fuss. And of course, when she was little, she fussed because she was either wet or she needed to feed. And so I was sort of trained as she starts to fuss, she needs something changed or something done. You know, my wife was the one to say, you know better, let her soothe herself if she will.
It's always reassuring to hear an expert say that they go through the same issues as everybody else.
It's always different when it's your kid. As somebody who trained in pediatrics, you learn that at a relatively young stage. It's one thing to sit there and tell the parent, you know, this is what you got to do. And then when you're living through it yourself, it's trying to remember what you tell everybody what to do sometimes is hard.
That was Dr. Paul Knowles speaking with reporter Chris Schultz about infant sleep. You can read a longer version of this interview on our website at wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University. West Virginia Morning is produced with help from Bill Lynch, Brianna Heaney, Chris Schultz, Curtis Tate, Emily Rice, Eric Douglas, Jack Walker, Liz McCormick, and Randy Yowie. Emily Rice and Chris Schultz produced today's show. I'm your host, Teresa Wills. This is West Virginia Morning.